Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. In President Biden's speech in Buffalo yesterday, he used the T word.
What happened here is simple and straightforward. Terrorism. Terrorism. Domestic terrorism.
President Biden also used the P word, power.
Violence inflicted in the service of hate and the vicious thirst for power that defines one group of people being inherently inferior to any other group.
So the P word and the H word, hate, but he also used the A words, angry and alienated.
A hate that through the media and politics, the internet, has radicalized angry, alienated, lost, and isolated individuals into falsely believing that they will be replaced, that's the word, replaced by the other, by people who don't look like them.
And he came back to the P word, in fact, two P words.
We have to refuse to live in a country where fear and lies are packaged for power and for profit.
President Biden in Buffalo yesterday. With me now is Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. He was previously with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch and Militia Task Force and a New York City police officer back in the 1980s. Professor Levin, thanks for coming on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. With a resume like that, someone everyone can hate.
There you go. And we're going to get into those different little bites of President Biden that I picked out, because I think each of them, you know, could launch a whole conversation. But first, where does the Buffalo mass murder fit into the arc of hate crimes in the United States as you study that arc right now? Racist killings of Black Americans are not all that new, obviously not at all new. But is there something very 2022 about this one, or not so much?
Oh, gosh, what a great question. And the data bears it out. Let me try and roll it out to you as quickly as I can. 2019 was a record year for FBI enumerated hate crime. There's all kinds of issues with how they count them, but it was a record for them. And it would have been a record even without the massacre in El Paso. So let's look macro, going back a little longer, right? Replacement theory, even before it got named that, has been around for decades and decades and decades in various incarnations here in the United States, and then germinated in France and Germany and elsewhere. What we had since about a decade ago were the string of manifesto killings, starting in Norway, and then we saw New Zealand, Charleston, South Carolina, you get the idea, El Paso. And we had a really interesting thing, just bear with me. In 2020, hate crimes, for instance, in New York City dropped, but the rest of the country was up. And the reason was anti-Semitic cases declined because of the gathering restrictions that took place. And we saw that, like, you know, Jews are twice as represented in major cities, and New York especially has the largest population of Jews of any in the country. So we had this interesting little kind of pause and realignment during 2020. So anti-Semitic went down, but in 2019, Jews were the top target in New York, LA, and Chicago. So what happened? We saw a carouseling of a bit of a realignment. First anti-Asian in March and April, and then particularly, listen to this, June 2020, we saw a bunch of stuff going on. First, we had this crescendo going from the Liberate Movement, which started on April 17th, of folks showing up places armed. Okay, and then we saw, you know, they were going to state capitol.
That was the anti-lockdown movement at that time, right?
Absolutely. And it took off on Facebook like crazy. We stopped counting because we had a staff intermission with regard to like our researchers and interns. So I stopped counting at over 200 of these liberate groups. And that kind of like laid the fertile ground for the insurrection, people will say, but it also laid the fertile ground for this kind of anti-black stuff that occurred. So just bear with me. We saw these civil guards, and certainly, you know, Kenosha, I think, was an example of how that can spin out of control. But in June 2020, we saw the largest number of social justice protests that we saw in recent decades. And there, by the way, there were some violent ones, but our colleagues at Princeton found over 94% were peaceful. And if you look at the leadership, they weren't talking about conspiracy theories and eliminationist doctrine, which labeled people who disagree with them as targets for violence and death. So what I'm saying is, yes, there were violent folks who were on the edges. But if you look at Sharpton, you look at Ben Crump, look at the Get Your Knee Off Our Necks rally, it was very conciliatory with respect to nonviolence and police. Go look at it, folks. I'll try and find it. I'm at Prof. Levin on Twitter. I'll put it up there since we can't do it on the show. The bottom line was we saw this visceral response that went from liberate, this elastic pool of grievance online, right? This elastic pool of grievance online translating to real world stuff. So as these increases in rallies occurred across the country, and they were very widespread, not just in big cities like New York, but in mid-sized cities and even small towns. What we saw was an expansion in the number of police departments that actually were able to identify at least one hate crime in their jurisdiction. So a multi-year high on that. But here's what else we saw. Here's the big one. June 2020 was the worst month for anti-black hate crime ever, going back to 91 when FBI started getting national stats. And that elevation, just listen to this, that elevation in anti-black hate crime, unlike previous spikes around like election 2016 or even 9/11, lasted months and months and months. So the spike that month was the second worst month for hate crime overall, according to FBI data that we disaggregated. But that elevation, that spike, went on for months. We have not seen that before. So that was historic. And
would you call that, if we're going to label that, would you call that a backlash? I used all those letters for Biden's language. Maybe this is the B word, backlash, to the outburst of protests after the George Floyd killing.
Absolutely. And by the way, there was over $1 billion in damage in some of the more violent ones. But what I'm saying to you is the leadership, Sharpton and Crump, specifically spoke out against it. And most of the killings were against black folks. And like here in California, we had a white supremacist run over a protester. So, let's look at it that way. But yes, there are some on the left who are violent, but they're violent in a different way.
No, I think I was asking a different question than you answered. The backlash is against the protests, even the peaceful ones that were taking place after the killing of George Floyd. But let me move on from that.
Yeah, Nick, one quick point on that. Listen to this.
Please.
Remember Lafayette Park? Right. And we saw this constant stream of videos on certain broadcast networks and elsewhere. BLM Antifa socialists, busloads and plane loads of Antifa coming to a town near you. The day of Lafayette Park that was cleared out of peaceful protesters, that was one of the five worst days ever for anti-black hate crime. So, yes, it was a backlash and there was a sticky internet and broadcast segment to this that kept that fear going for months and months and months. And it was used politically. So first blacks were burning down our towns along with socialist Antifa and all that. Then they were involved in stealing the election. And now they're involved with stealing our children with respect to their schools.
Right.
And even
and
this
those,
kind of pedophile stuff against Justice
the
Jackson.
Conspiracy theories. And how about
yes.
President Biden's P words, power and profit? Those are different than hate. How much do you see motivations and power of power or profit behind people pushing a belief in white supremacy today?
Hey, let, Great point. Let's look at this. When candidate Trump put his Muslim ban proposal out there 5 days after our community in San Bernardino was attacked, mm-hmm. his polls, Fox polls, by the way, showed him in the battleground state of South Carolina getting a 25% bump in just the days after that. And we also saw a 23% increase after the Muslim ban proposal in anti-Muslim hate crimes above the pop that we had from the terror attack. Now, about profit, I was on the air on Fox News Channel during the social justice protests, and I criticized Tucker Carlson using deceptive stats with regard to African-Americans. You know what? Never got called back on there again, but his ratings continued to climb. So there's a currency to this because let me just say why. Because the same kind of emotional, visceral response that we have to fear that can get people to be violent can also get people to come out to vote. Look, fear has been a part of politics for some time. But what I think is so terrible is the stickiness and the intertwining of the internet where you see this echo chamber where both kind of complement each other. And then we see this heightened elevation of hate crime on the streets. There's a correlation between invective online and violence in the street. And the one shoe that didn't drop was the mass killings until now. But we knew that steam was going to go somewhere as people were online more and getting radicalized mm-hmm. more, particularly with regard to this trading of memes and conspiracy theories. So one person, like, for instance, this terrorist may never have seen Tucker Carlson, but the memes and the lies and the conspiracy theories, as well as the eliminationist rhetoric. And we don't see that on the left. We don't see the homicides. We don't see the glorification of heavy weaponry that we see on the hard right.
So this conspiracy theory called replacement theory is gaining traction in some parts of white America. That's been getting a lot of press attention since the shooting in Buffalo. Can you explain this conspiracy theory for people who have only heard the term and only vaguely know what it is or where it came from?
Sure. We're experiencing demographic change, not only in the United States, but elsewhere. Last decade, we became a minority white Anglo-Christian country. And what has happened with that, this went from, for instance, the extreme. Everyone knows that we have demographic change going on, but now it's a conspiracy with Soros and Antifa and BLM. So what we have is this elastic pool of grievance, and it's fertilized by fear, and then this eliminationist doctrine knocks it another ratchet up. And so with regard to replacement theory, what it says is not only is there demographic change going on, but the people that are coming in are destroying the country in many different ways. And oh, by the way, leftists, socialists, Democrats, Antifa, Jews, Soros, they're all responsible for it. And that's what happened with the Tree of Life massacre. I don't even want to say his name, but he said, screw the optics. And he went after Jews. Why? Because they were part of this kind of Soros conspiracy to let in the caravan of immigrants. One quick thing, though, listen to this. Usually in election years, we see hate crimes rise later in the year. And we saw that in 2018, for instance, right? And November 2016, two worst months of the last decade. Now we're seeing fire season all year long. And that's something that I'm concerned about. Hate crime so far in 2022, 16 major cities, including New York, mm-hmm. up an average of 24%. And that's on top of an increase in 2021 and 2020.
So the population is actually changing. We all know that. The difference between what's real and what's conspiracy theory is the belief that someone is directing the population change for political gain.
Yes, two-part, that it's being nefariously organized by a cadre of enemies, and number two, that these immigrants that are coming in, which, by the way, like, thank God, because if you look at, like, for instance, in my little area, PhDs and researchers, but also the students of the children of immigrants who go to our school, they're doing beautifully. But what the other shoe on that conspiracy theory walk is that these immigrants are dirty, they're violent, they can't assimilate in any way, and they are alien to our culture, and it's part of an invasion that must be eliminated. So there's a whole, it's not only that someone's controlling it, but these people are violent, and we have to stand up against it. And you can hear it on Tucker Carlson all the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino, as we're putting the Buffalo mass murder terrorist attack, racist attack, into some kind of context here. 212-433-WNYC. If you have a question for Brian Levin, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. And not that hate has logic to begin with, but by replacement theory math, I mean, it's not black people who are replacing white people, and it's not Jews. The chant of Jews will not replace us, which was famously heard at Charlottesville, but Jews are only 2% of the American population, 2%. Black people have been around 13% for a very long time. And of course, the reasons there's even that much of a black population is that black people from Africa were brought here in chains for slavery, starting in 1619, as we all know, establishing that as an original American institution. So black Americans are as original American as any European. So how does this kind of attack, this kind of replacement theory, make any sense even to the perpetrators of it, except as an excuse for anti-blackness and anti-Semitism?
Well, it is. But look, there's always a grain of truth in horrible bigotry and conspiracy theories. And the fact of the matter is, we are demographically changing. That's not a bad thing. Indeed. And here's the other thing.
Just not in those directions.
What? But the Latino population grew quite a bit during the first decade of this century. And then, you know what? It moderated. And then Asians were growing at a faster clip. But the bottom line, it's non-whites. And here's the thing. Not everyone is as smart as you, Brian. They're looking at this, that anyone who's not me is an out-group. Out-group equals threat. And we have memes. And one other quick thing. I was on a panel with a psychologist, and she hit it out of the park. She said, there is a deliberative type of bigotry which comes about because, hey, someone takes an opposing position on me. Like, for instance, you know, people want to unionize, and the company says, oh, well, that's something that we don't like. Well, you know, well, okay, people have different sides. This is a little different. This is based on emotion. This is a visceral response to a feeling of fear that is cultivated by the very things that you referenced before, politicians, broadcasters, and others who know that this can get people to stay with them because it hits them where their fears are, where their gut is, rather than where their head is.
And potentially, this goes even further into uncharted and scary territory than we've even talked about so far, perhaps, you know, depending on your hierarchy there. But as some in the conservative movement look to autocracies around the world as models and openly question whether democracy is the best system for their interests, here's a clip that some of you will have heard this morning, listeners, from a report by NPR's Mara Liasson on Morning Edition today about the CPAC annual conservative conference being set this year for the country of Hungary because they admire their increasingly autocratic leader, Viktor Orban. Here's Mara.
So there are more and more conservatives who say, as Peter Thiel, one of the biggest donors now in the Republican Party, who said, democracy and freedom are not compatible. There are people who are questioning small-L liberalism on the right. Small-L liberalism meaning democracy with checks and balances, free press, independent judiciary, tolerance for diversity of backgrounds and opinions. So I think that the things that Orban has done to many people look undemocratic, but to a lot of conservatives, they look like the only way to save their way of life.
Whoa. Mara Liasson on Morning Edition today. Brian, have you heard that before? People saying out loud, democracy and freedom are not compatible as they identify with this sort of white Christian identity right wing?
Yes, but here's the thing that I think is so interesting. Prejudice has both depth, direction, and also an informational component. So you have different strata. You have some folks that say, no, you know, I don't want to change things so much, but, you know, blacks did steal the election. Or, you know, and then it becomes a rabbit hole. And what I'm saying to you is, when you look at the polls that say white people are under attack, even before the pandemic, it was up around 40, you know, with a 40%. So what I'm saying to you is, this fear is being stoked, but it's not like when I was at the ball game and I'm looking at the box scores and I'm kind of quiet, and the people next to me were clapping when there was a hit. So what I'm saying to you is, we have both a deliberative type of prejudice, but also a visceral one. And you don't have to have all your ducks in a row fact-wise, as long as feeling and image-wise. That's why with this teenage terrorist, memes were a large part of his, you know, the kind of 21st century bumper stickers were part of it. Peter Thiel, interesting enough, he was in my law school class and I knew him back then. Hmm. You know, listen to his anti-democratic stuff. For a while, you know, and we lionize money in this culture, right? And by the way, Peter's invited to my university anytime if he wants to have a discussion. But for some time, he was saying that America was at a competitive disadvantage because we gave women suffrage and their vote was like bleeding heart vote that would spend too much of government funds. That's why we needed pods in the ocean, these kind of like without governance. And he backtracked on the anti-woman suffrage thing. But like when you put that along with eliminationist language, bust their skulls, like President Trump said, or just this weekend, for instance, Ted Nugent, who knew that guy was still around, saying, bust the heads of Democrats. There is something different. And people call me all the time saying, what about the left? What about the left? Yeah, we've seen violence from the left, but generally the left believes in, like the social justice protests, they were about changing laws. They weren't about destroying the whole country. Although, yes, were there some slackers on that did? Probably. But when we look at on the hard far right and white supremacists, there's a whole ecosystem of eliminationist doctrine, kill them, and that these folks, whoever they are in this constellation, this elastic pool of grievance, they're all related. So it's Newsom out here in California, Governor Newsom, Antifa, BLM, they're all enemies, and they all are existential threats that must be eliminated. That's the kind of language that we're getting. Yeah. On the left, it's like a lot of hacking and insulting. And by the way, I've gone to these conflictual protests. A lot of times what the left will do is they'll direct violence to a particular target and then have fisticuffs and meant it humiliating them and getting them out of town as opposed to necessarily killing them. Since 2018, white supremacists, far right, have dominated the extremist homicides, according to our research here in the United States, and for some time before that as well.
By the way, on the Peter Thiel, women's suffrage is making us soft. He can backtrack, but he can't unsay it. So we know what was going on spontaneously in his brain. And also, that's one of the reasons that they like Viktor Orban, because like Putin, they've got this toxic masculinity, you know, totally, male supremacy, not just white supremacy, also male supremacy thing going on and traditional sex roles.
Yes, and that is it. Thank you so much. Oh, I love doing your show, Brian. Call anytime. There are so many tentacles to this. You are right. We have a separate incel movement, but nevertheless, this kind of toxic masculinity, another, just bear with me. White males are losing power. And one of the ways that we're doing this is from these, what did Rush Limbaugh used to call them? Feminazis. What do we do with Nazis? We destroy them. What does Putin say about Ukraine? They're Nazis. So you see the kind of eliminationist language. These folks who are the enemies represent an existential threat who must be destroyed. And toxic masculinity, as well as weapons, the weaponization fetish is out there too.
Let me get a few phone calls in here for you. Kathy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Brian Levin from University of California. Wait, I'm going to give you...
California State!
I'm just going to say, for people who don't know him, he's the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino, Brian Levin. Kathy, go. Now you're on. Sorry.
Yeah, all right. I just wanted to say that in all of the reports on this killing in Buffalo, they never bring up the parents. The parents knew he had guns in the home, and they did nothing. And the thing is that racism doesn't start with an 18-year-old. That you don't come into this world a racist. It starts with the parents. That's where the culture starts, and that's...
But not in this case. Not in this case. The parents apparently were like professors.
I read that he said in that 180-page thing that he posted that his parents didn't know that he was hiding the guns from his parents. He was hiding the fact that he dropped out of community college from his parents and his participation with these ideologies, right?
Right, and here's the thing. Great, great point. Look, sometimes the parents do, but in the Fourth Reich skinhead case 30 years ago here in California, they were going to kill Rodney King and mow down a church, black church. They got radicalized from a terrestrial peer group. Now what happened is, just bear with me, during the pandemic, we saw people go online more. And I do agree with you. Weapons acquisition is incredibly important to this. I had one of my friends who was victimized in the San Bernardino terror attack say, you know, hate is out there, but do we have to give them weapons of war to carry it out?
Todd in Somerset, you're on WNYC. Hi, Todd.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate your show very much.
Thank you.
Whether I can use my language properly, I hope. But what I wanted to say was that I think that this is a historical thing that has to do with people who have a way of life in the United States, and that they're afraid of losing their way of supporting themselves. And these are what I'm talking about, the white people, the people that live here. They're not just white, they're also black people, Clarence Thomas. For example, the liberals are trying to electrify the automobile, and a lot of people have a job dependence on gasoline and on motor cars and other things, diesels. And so the amount of change that's happening is making people afraid, and that's why they're lashing out violently. Their fear for their way of life, their support. And this has always been a thing in the United States with people who've moved here, and that they're making a living here, and that they feel that this is being threatened, that their way of life, because of all the change that's happening, that's being partly spurred by liberals. And that's what I think is causing this violence.
I'm sorry, what's spurred by liberals? I kind of missed that part. I was with you up until then.
You're talking about the example that you gave was electrification of motor vehicles when a lot of people have jobs in the fossil fuels industry.
Yes, if you drive around, you see gas stations everywhere. And these people and all the people who are into developing the construction industry, the diesel mechanics, that they're feeling that they're going to lose their way of life, their jobs. Much, much greater than the coal industry, I think, on another level of...
take that out on ethnic or religious differences?
Because it's liberals. They're taking out on Jews. They think that Jews are aliens, that they're going to take away their way of life, their jobs. They're taking away, in general, on a liberal basis.
Todd, thank you. Do you agree with his sociological analysis at all?
In small part, let me tell you what I mean. If you looked at the White Aryan Resistance comics from the 80s, for instance, and earlier, right, they would have white people built this country. So what I'm saying to you is, you know, there's it's a constellation of interconnected changes, fears, and threats. So it's not only... It's change overall, and that change goes from everything to you used to be able to work in a factory and build things to now the left is going to take away our hamburgers. So what I'm saying to you is it's a multifaceted threat, even when it's not even related. Change is occurring because the world changes, irrespective of who's behind the levers, right? You know, so what I'm saying to you is this notion of attaching any type of uncomfortable change to some conspiracy is something that we've seen on the hard right for some time. But what I think is so interesting now is that, you know, people talk about the internet. It's not just the internet. It's how we communicate with each other and how conspiracies and stereotypes that label who is the legitimate target of aggression based on this fear is an amorphous pool. So it includes, you know, the vegans, it includes Antifa. I was on a radio show earlier today out of New Orleans. Somebody called in and said, you know, Antifa did the terror, did the insurrection. So, you know, right. So any kind of change, but also any kind of thing that could be regarded as violent is immediately shifted over to that out group. And that out group has been fairly consistent, but now it's much more amorphous because of the internet and conflictual eliminationist politics, which labels anyone that's in an out group as a legitimate target for violence.
And we have to leave it there with Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. He was previously with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch and Militia Task Force and a New York City police officer in the 1980s. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.